This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. By the early 1970s, racial tension in Wilmington, North Carolina was thick. Many people in the African-American community were frustrated and outraged at the way the Wilmington School Board managed the desegregation of the city's public schools. There were protests and boycotts. The Ku Klux Klan patrolled the streets. And it all came to a head on February 6, 1971, when a white-owned business in Wilmington was firebombed. Firefighters say they were shot at when they arrived at Mike's Grocery. They say the shots came from the roof of a nearby church. Rioting followed. Two people were killed. The National Guard stormed the church, and 10 people were arrested, 9 black men and 1 white woman. The Wilmington 10 were quickly convicted of arson and conspiracy related to racial violence. The sentences ranged from 7 to 29 years. Amnesty International called the trial a miscarriage of justice and identified the Wilmington 10 as political prisoners. In 1980, a federal court overturned the convictions. But the 10 were never pardoned, and that is an important legal distinction. That may change soon, as outgoing Governor Bev Perdue is reportedly considering a pardon, and there is some new evidence to suggest the original prosecution was even more racially biased than originally reported. We're going to take a look at the case and the new evidence today with Timothy Tyson, a visiting professor of American Christianity and Southern Culture at Duke Divinity School. Irving Joyner is a professor of law at North Carolina Central and co-chair of the Wilmington 10 Pardons of Innocence Project. And Cash Michaels is a journalist, filmmaker, and coordinator of the Wilmington 10 Pardons of Innocence Project. Welcome to all of you. Good to have you on the program.
Thanks for having us, Frank.
Tim, talk about this new evidence. What is it? It has to do with the prosecutor at the time, Jay Stroud. What'd you find?
Jay Stroud is the attorney who prosecuted the case for the state. These are his personal notes during the prosecution. They include, in particular, jury selection notes, which indicate that he was engaged in a number of illegal and unethical practices, including discriminating against black jurors, including trying to pack the jury with Ku Klux Klan members. There are notations beside each prospective juror about how good a juror, what kind of juror they might, what their thoughts. And his notations say KKK, good, good, possibly KKK. You know, and certainly at the very top on page one of the jury selection notes, it says, stay away from black men. So those are some of the things that are there. There's also the question of the bribery of witnesses, which the Fourth District U.S. Court found problematic. And there's correspondence between the main witness and Prosecutor Stroud offering to perjure himself against the Wilmington 10 in exchange for having a woman sent to him. They take him out of jail and put him in a beach cottage at Riceville Beach. You know, one of the other juvenile witnesses defendant is given a mini bike and their cash, and this is
And where did this new evidence come from?
It was in the back of a deep closet at the district attorney's office in New Hanover County in downtown Wilmington. And Ben David, the current district attorney, found the box, which was marked Wilmington 10. And he knew that that was an important historic event. And he knew me. So he said, could you, you know, make sure that these documents, you know, make their way safely to where they need to be? And so I took them to the Southern Historical Collection, where they would not turn to dust or be burned in a fire or any of the terrible things that sometimes happens to our history. So, you know, his argument, I think, was that these documents belong to history, not to the district attorney's office, and at this point that they would be more useful in the archive.
Well, there are other interesting findings as well, and we'll talk about them. But Irving Joyner, you're an attorney, and I want to ask you about this. Just getting back to jury selection, isn't that What Tim Tyson just described, isn't that precisely what attorneys do? They make these discriminations based on who they think is going to best serve their case. I mean, is that illegal or unethical, what Stroud was doing? You may not like it, but isn't that what lawyers do?
Well, I think it's a normal practice for attorneys to try to get some feel for the potential jury panel and some idea about who they are and what their likely receptability is. For years, though, the law has declared that it is illegal to discriminate against people on the basis of race in jury selection. And subsequent to this trial, the court decided in the Batson case that that was a violation of the 14th Amendment due process and equal protection clauses. But even before that, it was widely known in the within the profession, and certainly the rules of professional responsibility, that you can't discriminate against people in jury selection based on their race. And what Jay Stroud did in this instance was to go over and above what normally attorneys do, and specifically identify those persons who had a racial bias based on their philosophy, based on their lifestyle, based on their political organizations and activities, to try to stack the jury with those type people for the sole purpose of convicting 10 people, 9 African Americans and 1 white, for crimes that they did not commit, knowing all along that they did not commit these crimes. And specifically point out that the exclusion of African-American males and females was a high order in the jury selection scheme by the prosecutor. So to that extent, even in 1971 and 1972, that was a practice that was unprofessional and certainly illegal.
And these practices took place in the second trial. The first trial ended in mistrial, and you found some evidence to suggest that that was not accidental.
Absolutely.
Yes. The second trial, well, in the first trial, the tentative jury panel consisted of 10 African Americans and 2 whites, and this was following almost a week of jury selection. And then there were notes, and I guess Tim can talk about this as well, in which the prosecutor had on the back of a pad advantages and disadvantages of a mistrial, a calculated effort to determine whether, because of the situation that was existing at that time, whether he needed to bail out of the trial. And kind of mysteriously and overnight, he became sick. And the judge had to declare a mistrial when it was determined that the New Hanover County District Attorney's Office couldn't proceed without him. But the notes indicate that before he got sick, he weighed the advantages and disadvantages of there being a mistrial in calculating then how his representation to the court would be, and clearly that was perjury.
Well, let me ask,
certainly misleading the court.
So, Tim, what are the advantages and disadvantages according to his own notes?
His main ones were a new judge. He felt that the judge he had been given was not the best judge for his case to win, and then he wanted a new jury, as he put it. And then there were some other. He was worried about the witnesses, particularly Alan Hall, who was crazy as a bedbug, and he had also been bribed and offered a lesser sentence and given conjugal visits at the beach and whatnot. But even so, he was not sure how long Alan Hall's willingness to commit perjury was. You know, what the expiration date on Alan Hall was. He was thought, if we have to wait for another trial, he might not be willing to do the deal. So that was on the list as well. It's a strike, I believe that, and I wanted to ask Attorney Joyner a question, which is, I don't know the answer to, which is that you get a mistrial. For him to deliberately, I mean, obviously, when we get sick, we do not make a list of pros and cons of getting sick. We just get sick. Right. We don't decide, let's get sick. You know, what would be, usually we don't like getting sick and we get sick against our will. He gets sick because he finds the advantages of doing so outweigh the disadvantages. So then he is defrauding the court, he is lying to the judge in order to secure a more favorable outcome. As an officer of the court, Mr. Joyner, does that, Professor, do we, does that...
can you do that?
Can you do that? Yeah. Is that within the rules of the game?
Well, you got it.
Yeah, that's clearly in violation of the rules of professional responsibility, misleading the court on a significant issue like that. But it's also perjury and fraud on the tribunal, where you present this false reason for there being an abortion of a trial, because the law says that every defendant is entitled constitutionally to the jury that's selected. And here you're in the process of selecting a jury where there was a constitutional attachment to those individuals, and now someone who is an officer of the court comes along to abort that process and to keep that individual or those individuals from having the benefit of those jurors. That was both illegal and a violation of the Code of Professional Responsibility.
On the state of things today, considering whether to pardon the Wilmington 10, their cases already, their verdicts and convictions have already been overturned. The case is 40 years old. Timothy Tyson is a visiting professor of American Christianity and Southern Culture at Duke. Irving Joyner, a professor of law at North Carolina Central. Cash Michaels, we'll talk to him in a minute, a journalist, filmmaker, and coordinator of the Wilmington 10 Pardons of Innocence Project. And our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about the new effort to win pardons for the Wilmington 10. Timothy Tyson is with us from Duke University. Irving Joyner, a professor of law at North Carolina Central. Cash Michaels, journalist, filmmaker, and coordinator of the Wilmington 10 Pardons of Innocence Project. And Cash Michaels, tell us about that. What is this effort? What are you trying to do?
Frank, it's good to be with you and Tim and Irv. The Wilmington 10 Pardons of Innocence Project is a justice outreach of the National Newspaper Publishers Association, which is a trade organization of some 200 African-American newspapers across the country, and also with the Wilmington Journal newspaper, an African-American newspaper that I work for in Wilmington. In 2011 is when the NNPA had determined that seeking once and for all pardons of innocence for the Wilmington 10 was going to be something that they were going to go after, and it was January of this year that I was appointed to be a coordinator. Generally speaking, what we have been trying to do is obviously not only making application, and Irv, who is an extraordinary attorney and human being, I might add, and James Ferguson, who was the lead defense attorney for the Wilmington 10 40 years ago, made application to the Governor's Office of Executive Clemency back in May 17th to be exact, for indeed individual pardons of actual innocence for all 10 members of the Wilmington 10. Please keep in mind that at that time, 7 were still living, 3 had already deceased. In August, the fourth Wilmington 10 member, Connie Tyndall, age 62, had died after a stroke. What we've been trying to do in the last 6 or so months is not only push for the pardons of innocence, but we've had to educate a new generation. We're talking about a case that's 40 years old. So we've had to educate not only a new education, a new generation, but also re-educate folks who were here and they have slim memory of it. Many people who do remember it clearly, at least in their minds, are folks who are opposed to pardons of innocence for the Wilmington 10. This was a period of great racial tension. I know that Tim can speak to this, certainly, and I know that Irv, which we forgot to mention, Irv was actually in the courtroom. He was actually part of the team defending them. But this was a period of great racial tension. It was just 3 short years after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. The South was still going through a lot of back and forth as far as the white power structure, not wanting to give up power. African-Americans standing up and saying the time has come. And that's what hit New Hanover County like a battering ram. That's what brought the Reverend Benjamin Chavis from the United Church of Christ to Wilmington to stand with the black students who had boycotted the public school system there because of racial discrimination. That's what got Reverend Eugene Templeton, who is the white pastor of a black church, Gregory Congregational of a church in the heart of the black community, who allowed the black students and Ben Chavis to be there to meet, to have rallies, to hold classes that they were missing because they had boycotted the public school system. And that ultimately was the ground zero for the white supremacists and trucks who would drive by the church and fire weapons at it. And then ultimately on the night of February 6th, 1971, the burning of Mike's Grocery. That was blamed on the Wilmington 10. However, and you said something in the beginning when you had your opening that the National Guard had come in and had arrested 9 black males and a white female after they went to the church. That's not true. No one was arrested until a year later. There was nobody in the church after Mike's Grocery was burned and they finally stormed the church. There was nobody there. Everyone had already left. They did not start arrest until a year later. And originally they had arrested 16 people. And then when they couldn't find anybody who would turn state's evidence against Ben Chavis, who was who they really wanted, then that's when they whittled it down to 10. And then that's when the trials commenced in June of 1972.
And Irving Joyner, you were there, part of the defense team. What were the charges? And as Cash Michael suggests, there's really no physical evidence, so it's all going to hang on the testimony of witnesses.
Right. The charges were conspiracy to commit arson, the arson of Mike's Grocery, assault on emergency personnel, police officers and firemen, and conspiracy to assault emergency personnel were the basic charges that were tried in the Wilmington 10, this Wilmington 10 trial. There were other charges that were not tried at that time and were left to be tried at a later point. Those cases have not been resolved. But they were convicted of the other charges that I mentioned to you earlier.
And let's talk about these witnesses. Alan Hall, for one, who Tim Tyson described as crazy as a bedbug, he did have some history of mental illness and, in fact, attacked an attorney at one point during the trial. Is that right?
He did. During the trial, during cross-examination, where he was caught in any number of misstatements or lies, as we call it in the street, between what he was saying at trial and allegedly what he had provided in a written statement to Jay Stroud. With each contradiction that he was caught in, he became more angry. And then after a spirited day of cross-examination, he simply just got up from the witness stand and attempted to physically attack Jim Ferguson in the courtroom, had to be restrained by the bailiff as he was lunging over the counsel table to attack Attorney Ferguson.
Restrained, but not removed.
Right, not removed, and then following the retaining of order in the courtroom, the trial judge admonished Attorney Ferguson for upsetting him. For doing exactly what an attorney is supposed to do in cross-examining a witness. And here you have these alleged contradictions that he tried to explain away by saying that he had made them in another statement. And the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals concluded that that information was perjury, that it was not true, and at the time that he made those statements, that not only did the prosecutor know that those statements were not true, but the trial judge also knew that those statements were not true because he had examined the very same document that Hall was making reference to, and that is why they reversed the convictions of the Wilmington 10 initially.
Well, and Tim, let's talk about that judge for a minute, because that getting a new judge was one of Stroud's reasons for a mistrial, and this was a great judge to have if you wanted a conviction in this case. Tell us about this particular judge. He had just come off a case, didn't he, trying, maybe you knew about this, Herb, but I think he had tried Ben Chavis's, a man who was accused of killing Ben Chavis's cousin.
Cousin, right.
That's
in,
correct.
Oxford.
That's correct. Robert Martin.
Yes, Judge Robert Martin. And this is, that killing and that case was the subject of Tim's book and movie, Blood Doesn't Sign My Name. Which occurred several months before the Wilmington uprising, which occurred. So Robert Martin was specifically assigned over the chief Superior Court judge in that district at the time, Judge Joshua James, who presided over the first case and did an outstanding job and was very fair to everyone, to the consternation of Jay Stroud. So one of the things that he certainly wanted to do was to have a change in judges, and that did occur. And in addition to that was a effort to get litigation support from the North Carolina Attorney General's office, where they were asked to assign an attorney to help him in the further persecution of the Wilmington 10.
So tell us about this now, this new effort, because maybe I'll put this question to you, Cash Michaels. The convictions are overturned by a federal court. Why doesn't this lead to pardon? What's the distinction, and why didn't it happen when the convictions were overturned?
All right, well, that's probably more a question for Irv. You just asked me a legal question.
Yeah, well, okay, Irv, go ahead.
Well, basically, you know, what the Fourth Circuit said was that there were some significant constitutional violations which occurred. Therefore, we are going to reverse the conviction and send it back to Wilmington for another trial. So you have to try it again or dismiss the charges. Neither one occurred. There was not another trial, nor were the charges dismissed. So those charges for the last 40 years have basically hung over their heads. But more important than that, it shows up on their records. And every time members of the Wilmington 10 went to look for a job, the employer would pull up the record and they would see these convictions. And the record that they pulled up does not show that they were reversed. When they attempted to get into school, the school authorities would pull up that record. No matter what they did, that record was there. That record is still there. And it caused all kinds of havoc in their lives, destroyed careers. These were all able and promising young people who had an opportunity to do a lot with their lives, and these charges and convictions basically destroyed and demolished every dream that they had. So now what we are looking for is at least the opportunity to clear their names. Some have already passed, as Cash indicated. Others are still alive, but they want their names cleared. Not that they can get these super jobs now, not that they can go to school, but they want their names cleared. And the people in Wilmington want to see their names cleared. And the only agency now that can do that is the governor of the state of North Carolina.
And would they also, with a pardon, be eligible for restitution?
That part I don't know. We have not addressed that issue, although some people make that claim. There is a lot of legal issues that we have to look at, but that's not the focus of what it is that we're doing here.
Tim Tyson, you're a historian. You got to look at this box of records that, as you say, was in kind of the back of the closet. You've looked over a lot of records in your life, and I wonder if you were surprised particularly by how blunt and just the nature of these particular documents.
The white supremacy, implicit and explicit, in these documents transcends anything I've ever seen in the archive. They don't usually write this kind of thing down. And, you know, one of the things I was so struck by was that in the jury selection notes, they asked jurors, do you read the Wilmington Journal, which is the African-American newspaper in Wilmington? That newspaper was burned to the ground in 1898. The following year, it was bombed and destroyed in 1972. So there's a hostility to the black press in these things. Also, one of the just odd little quirks is, it was really a point against the juror if they referred to Ben Chavis as Reverend Chavis or Mr. Chavis, using courtesy titles for black folk was a kind of unacceptable. It was a custom not to in the South, and that was we were at a cusp when things were changing. And I think it's important to understand the political atmosphere in which this happens is one of white black backlash. George Wallace in 1968 came in as an independent third party candidate who's, you know, slick-haired segregationist, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever, from Alabama. He beat the Democratic presidential candidate in North Carolina. In 72, he beat Terry Sanford, our native son, who really would have made a fine president in the Democratic primary in his home state, ending Terry Sanford's national political hopes. You had white officials who believed it was appropriate to use their positions to roll back or resist the changes brought by the civil rights movement. And I think this is at the heart of the situation.
Well, you know what? It's interesting, too, Tim, because your father, Vernon Tyson, was a pastor up in Oxford for that first trial, that trial in Oxford that we talked about earlier. He then finds himself in Wilmington and in the center of this controversy in that church. And he tells a story, and I think this is relevant when you talk about why you bother to go back. Why reopen a case that's 40 years old? I think what he heard in that church, and maybe you can tell the story, tells you why it's relevant to unpack wounds that have not been healed.
My brother went to Hoggard High School, the new school, and which is integrated for the first time, and there was violence in the hallways, and education had pretty much ground to a halt. Bertha Todd, who was a wonderful woman, who was a assistant principal out there, she and my father called a meeting just for parents at his church to talk about, among black and white parents, how to get education back going at school and violence at an end. And he was listening to the African-American parents, he realized that there were these references to, well, you know, what happened, the thing that happened. Well, since what happened, you know. And he realized that the white parents were just nodding vacantly or looking confused, trying to pretend they knew what the reference was to, and that he didn't know and he didn't think they knew. So he asked, and there was some disbelief among the black parents that he didn't know what they were referring to. And then he said, well, no, but please, what is it? And a black woman stood up and pointed and said, they say that river was full of black bodies. And they were talking about 1898, the bloody overthrow of the interracial fusion regime and the coup that brought in Jim Crow and that killed an unknown number of citizens of the black majority in Wilmington, which was at that time the largest city in our state, and also the stronghold of the fusion movement. So that was with us much. When the Rights of White People group met in Hugh McCrae Park, which was named after the man who led the mob in 1898, when they met there across the street from my junior high school, they constantly referred to 1898 and filling the river with black bodies. It was the grist of their political rhetoric. And so, the ghosts of 1898 walked among us.
Among us in black communities, and yet in the white communities, you said, no, because it is still, by that time, was still being called the race riot and was not understood at all in the way we've come to understand it. So two communities, very different ideas, wounds that hadn't healed, and here they are back in 1971, 72. So Irving Joyner, let me ask you what happens here in the pardon, because we've talked about evidence in this case, new evidence that shows up in these notes by Jay Stroud. And yet the pardon process isn't a judicial one, is it? It's an executive process. This is something that Bev Perdue can simply decide with or without evidence. Am I right about that?
Right. This is based on the North Carolina Constitution, which gives to the governor unlimited power to grant pardons and commutations to people at her discretion. She has instituted, and to her credit, a process by which these pardon applications will be vetted. And the Wilmington 10 is not the only one that she is looking at this point. And they have been looking at the petitions and information that we filed in support of those position those petitions that but you know that those petitions now are basically enhanced or undergirded by these new findings that we got from Tim Tyson, which confirms the racist nature, the deep racist nature of this prosecution, and confirms everything that we had thought had occurred, although we did not raise that in the petitions themselves, because we wanted to look at only those things which were a record, which could be confirmed, which you could find and confirm immediately without any debate. Now we have this other stuff that comes along to confirm just how racist the prosecution was, and we're turning that over to the governor for her evaluation as well.
You know, Frank, you know, Governor Hunt, in 1978, commuted their sentences but declined to pardon them. The Fourth District Court in 1980 overturned the sentences, but that did not make a pardon. We see clearly now, I think, what we couldn't see then, which is that African-American full citizenship is no threat to us, that we have to live together. This is a wonderful opportunity, I think, for Governor Perdue, who's the feistiest governor we've had in some time, to perform an act of healing and reconciliation. I think that this might have been done earlier, but we're in a position where it needs to be done. This reconciliation has to happen, and I believe that she knows what it is to be excluded, and I think she should step forward and do this, and I hope she will.
I want to thank you all for being on the program. Timothy Tyson, visiting professor of American Christianity and Southern Culture at Duke, Irving Joyner, professor of law at North Carolina Central, and Cash Michaels, journalist, filmmaker, and coordinator of the Wilmington 10 Pardons of Innocence Project.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you very much.
Coming up next, music from the Blue Ribbon Healers. Stay tuned.